You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Pentagon recently announced it was deploying additional Marines to Afghanistan to ensure stability in the country before troop reductions begin. I'm not exactly sure when, but soon. A key step to securing peace in the region resists being resolved: how to wean the country's farmers off of poppy farming. National Geographic contributing writer Robert Draper spent time in Helmand Province, where most of the country's opium is grown, and he has called his article about the situation, Opium Wars. It appears in the February issue of the magazine, and it brings Robert Draper to our show today. Hello.
Hello there.
How much of the world's illegal opium comes out of Afghanistan?
About 90%. And when we last did a story on opium, National Geographic, that was in 1986, I believe, that figure was 19%. So I remember looking at that story, which was a survey throughout the world, and asking myself, my goodness, what happened? And a variety of factors did happen. This isn't a phenomenon that took place overnight. Certainly not a phenomenon that's going to change overnight.
Well, it was grown further to the east in the past, wasn't it? In soil that was very good for opium poppies. Is Afghanistan a good place to grow them?
It is. It's for a variety of reasons. Afghanistan has very loamy soil, and poppy is something that does not require a lot of water, which is good for Afghanistan since they don't irrigate. And it's good for the farmers because it has a very short growing season, doesn't require a lot of expertise. You basically just fling some seeds on the ground. Within 4 months, the crop comes up. It's very tedious to harvest the opium from poppies, but it also doesn't require a degree in agronomy to do so.
But is Afghanistan now the leading grower of opium because those other countries clamp down on their farmers growing it, or is it simply that it's easier to grow it in Afghanistan under the current situation?
Well, there are a couple of factors at work, and one of them is, yes, that the other countries, particularly its neighboring countries like India and Pakistan, stopped growing it. So for the drug smugglers, they were on the lookout for a country that would be hospitable to a black market.
And Myanmar would be the alternative,
sure.
Largely. And Myanmar is a country that is harder to deal with.
That's right, exactly. Now, what also was going on, though, was that Afghanistan used to grow a lot of crops. They were famous for their pomegranates, their pistachios, their grapes, which went all the way. The grapes were prized in the former Soviet Union. But with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, the Soviets deliberately shut off, for example, the cotton markets to favor some of its Soviet bloc countries. And a lot of infrastructure was damaged during the war in Afghanistan during that decade-long period. And so when Afghanistan emerged from the Soviet occupation, they found that it was difficult for them to grow crops, but in the meantime, that their neighboring countries didn't want them anymore because they had developed their own markets. So now they had no market to sell these crops, but there was suddenly a vacuum in the marketplace, and that was for opium.
Is it just coincidental that a major market for their opium is Russia? Did the Soviet troops become addicted while they were there?
There's some evidence of that, and there's always been a level of addiction in that area, but nothing like it is now. And for that matter, always been a certain amount of opium that was produced in Afghanistan going back centuries. Alexander the Great was said to have introduced opium to the area in the 4th century B.C. And
that doesn't make him sound so great.
No. Well, nor is it so great that he was unable to conquer Afghanistan, except perhaps by introducing—
But nobody's conquered Afghanistan.
No, that's right. But if anyone has come closest, it's probably Alexander the Great, since he introduced a crop that maybe has— shackled Afghanistan more than any other.
Isn't opium trade the main source of income for the Taliban?
Yes. We don't know whether it is the main source. At one time, it clearly was. Now they do have other revenue streams. What is clear is that they are heavily involved in opium smuggling, have been for some time, this despite the fact that it is supposed to be haram forbidden by Islam.
And how do they justify that? It's forbidden along with alcohol, mm-hmm. as you say, by the Quran. Mullah Omar the supreme leader of the Taliban issued a fatwa banning opium growth when the Taliban was in power.
Sure, he did it in 2000, and we were quite impressed by that. The West was. It later developed that the reason that Mullah Omar had done so was to increase the demand and drive up the price for opium. They stockpiled opium for a couple of years, and then sometime after the American invasion of Afghanistan, in an effort to be able to finance their activities, they began to rely on opium more.
So is that the reason they give for supporting the growth of opium, that it's their main source of income?
They don't give a reason. In fact, I asked the Taliban spokesperson about this, and he said, well, you can certainly have a debate on the subject. And indeed, a lot of mullahs have done so. Some of them take the position that, well, it is forbidden to take opium, but not necessarily to cultivate it. Others suggest and point to passages in the Quran that say that the starving man may eat haram meat, forbidden meat, in order to survive. And so that's analogous to the situation with poppies. And for that matter, there are a number of mullahs in Afghanistan who grow poppies. So you can imagine where they stand on the subject.
Well, is are the Taliban playing a direct role in opium production and trafficking? Are they encouraging farmers to grow it?
It's more direct than just encouraging. I mean, they help facilitate its passage through out of Afghanistan, and they keep roads open. And to this degree, many farmers prefer this system than back when there was a power vacuum and there were warlords and corrupt police occupying the roads. Now the rules of the roads, so to speak, are known. Essentially, the Taliban get 10% of the crops straight off the top, and in return for that, oftentimes you not only don't have to go to market on the lousy roads in Afghanistan, but the market comes to you in the form of traffickers on top of motorcycles or in trucks who will pick up the bricks of opium and then transport it out.
Just the Taliban?
No, not just the Taliban. There is a fairly shadowy, fairly amorphous group of quote unquote drug lords, and these are individuals who are not necessarily Afghan. Some of them are from Pakistan, and indeed helped introduce into Nangarhar and Badakhshan province the know-how to cultivate cultivate poppy and produce opium. And these individuals, these drug lords, operate sort of on all levels. I mean, they pay a lot of money to Afghan officials, to Afghan politicians, both on the provincial level and on the national level. And they, in ways that are not fully understood, operate in concert with the Taliban to move the opium out of the country.
So everybody's getting a little piece of the action.
Yeah, and we should point out, Leonard, that the people, of course, unsurprisingly, who are getting the least amount of the action are ones who
farmers.
Are growing it themselves. Yes, these guys, with very, very few exception, are not getting rich off of this very, very rich source of income. They're subsistence farmers, often at best. And so the efforts from time to time to eradicate poppy become a real, not just bread and butter issue, but life and death issue for these farmers.
Robert Draper's article, Opium Wars, is in the February issue of National Geographic magazine. There was an upsurge after the U.S. invaded.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
The U.S. tried to do everything possible to suppress the growth of opium poppies?
Well, the U.S. has been in a kind of internal wrestle over what to do about this, Leonard. At various junctures, we have supported forced eradication, then pulling back and allowing the Karzai administration to do what they need to do. Now we have been a little bit more aggressive in our attempts, in particular in Helmand province down in the south where the majority of opium is produced. To wean farmers away from opium, and we're doing that through the Marines by paying farmers to eradicate their own crops and then to give them alternative seeds, the seeds to alternative crops as well as fertilizers in hopes that then in the next season they will not grow poppy. And this season is upon us now, and we shall see.
But it's pretty easy to spot poppy growth, isn't it?
Oh, I should say, yes, except that because poppies are they're brilliantly colored. Anybody who has seen The Wizard of Oz would know this. But because of eradication efforts, for example, in Badakhshan province to the north, the farmers have become quite clever about concealing it. They will use most of their farmland to grow wheat or other crops. And then just in these creases that are well out of plain view and far away from any farm-to-market road, if you walk long enough and up and down hills enough, you'll suddenly see this blaze of color shoot out at you. And, of course, those small half-hectare or hectare constitute the majority of their income, since they can get so much more money from opium than they can from, say, wheat or pomegranates or the like.
And we talk about 85% of the Afghan population being farmers. So what percentage of what they produce is opium?
It's hard to say, and it depends on the season because there are droughts and other conditions. But what can be said is that the vast majority of their income comes from poppy, and that has pretty much ever been thus, or at least over the last few decades.
Now, what are they actually selling? They're growing these poppies. Are they then processing them into some other kind of form, or are they selling the whole poppy head to somebody else to process?
No, what they do, Leonard, is that they'll go out in the fields themselves. After the poppy bulbs are ready, they will take a little blade and score the bulbs a few times and make these little slits in them, and then allow this kind of dark pus-like stuff to seep out. That's the raw opium. And then they will the next day come out, scrape this paste out, and then form bricks with them, wrap them with plastic sheets or something like that. And then one of the many advantages to growing poppy over, say, wheat or melons or something is that this has a nearly indefinite shelf life. You can store all of this stuff, not only for weeks and weeks and wait for the guy to come and pick it up, or alternatively, if market conditions aren't right, if the price has gone way down for opium, you hang on to it. You keep it under your floorboards, as many farmers do, and wait till the market has become more favorable.
And in this form, is that how it's used, or does it have to go through another process? But later, if you decide, you can then take that opium and process it into heroin or any number of other things, some of them legal.
That's right. With the introduction of a couple of chemicals, it can be processed into heroin. And
is that done in Afghanistan?
Sometimes, but usually done near the border. It's a lot easier to transport it when it's in the form of heroin. It's not quite as bulky. But there are staging areas near the borders of Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, where that processing takes place. It does not take place on the farms.
How dependent is Afghanistan's economy on opium farming?
Well, it's something I point out in the story, that there are two revenue streams basically in Afghanistan, and they happen to be in direct competition with each other. One of them, Afghanistan gets part of its money from the West in the form of aid. And the West is giving Afghanistan money, has given them billions and billions over the last 10 years in hopes of moving the country's hearts and minds away from the Taliban. On the other side is opium, and Afghanistan gets the rest of its revenue from opium, which, of course, is used by the Taliban to help fund its own activity. So the two are in absolute conflict with each other.
But at the same time, they're two addictive things.
They are.
Western aid and opium.
Sure. No, that's right. And all the more so since a lot of the money never gets to where it's needed. I've never seen corruption so endemic as I have in Afghanistan, and I've been to a lot of horrific countries. And of course, this is a very corrosive situation for the Afghan people. It means that, for one thing, that they don't buy in to their government, their newly elected democratic government, and it means as well as they don't buy into the West, because they hear tell of all this money coming in, and they see very little in the way of results, very little in the way of direct help.
My guest is Robert Draper, whose article, Opium Wars, is in the current issue, the February issue of National Geographic, with photographs by David Guttenfelder. And we have a slideshow of some of those photographs that go along with the article on our website as well as a link to that article on our website at WNYC.org. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Robert Draper, who's a contributing writer to the National Geographic, and he's written an article for the February issue called Opium Wars, with photographs by David Guttenfelder. And as I said earlier, you can see some of them, a slideshow of them, on our website, as long as find links to the article. Now, you investigated this thing by actually going into the areas where it was being farmed and processed. Wasn't that dangerous?
It was, yes. It was something we determined from the outset that to do a story that would have value, that would be different from other looks at Afghanistan, we'd need to spend time with poppy farmers, which would involve going sort of way off the road.
But I would think it would also put you in contact with the Taliban or other people who understood that if their story was known, might be in danger themselves.
Sure. For example, in Nangarhar province where we were, we stayed at with a couple of people from USAID. One of them was a young lady who'd been working there, a Scottish woman who'd worked there just for a few months. And about 2 months after we left the compound, she was kidnapped by Taliban sympathizers and killed. And so these risks were ever present. When we were in Badakhshan province, it's an utterly lawless area on the Tajikistan border. Beautiful. Looks like Nepal. And maybe 90% of the people you meet have that famous Afghan sense of hospitality. The other 10%, however, aren't just indifferent or hostile towards you. They want to kill you or kidnap you. And so you can do what you can to minimize the risks, talk to local sheikhs and get a sense of what roads are safe and what are not. But you never know when you're going to get sold out and you're putting your life in your own hands by going out there.
And were those hospitable people also willing to talk to you about what was going on?
They were, but it was never a push-button exercise. It took time. And these are individuals who aren't used to talking to Westerners at all, much less to reporters, are not convinced that you're on the level, might think you're a spy. So it helps to have someone on the ground, as we did, a fixer who was a local journalist who showed us. We hired one for each province who was able to put us in touch with the local chief of police, local sheikhs, and we'd sit down and talk with them over tea. And gradually, we would then be able to go off-road and meet certain farmers.
Often those fixers are in more danger than the people they're doing the fixing for. I've spoken to a number of people who were Western journalists who were kidnapped in Afghanistan. They wound up being freed, but their fixers were killed because the Taliban saw them as traitors.
Absolutely. The one we hired in Kabul, for example, had been held a couple of weeks before when he was on another assignment, and a couple of weeks after we left was threatened by the Taliban as well. Yes, they're the ones who are staying there, and it's something that in a broader sense we have to remember about our policy in Afghanistan, since the president has announced a date of withdrawal, everyone on the ground there in Afghanistan is cognizant of the fact that we are on the clock and that.
Well, it's not now July, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, we've it's 2012 is when we'll begin withdrawal. 2014 is when we're supposed to have withdrawal completed. We've moved the goalposts a little bit, but what this means is that farmers are dealing with people who won't be around much longer. And even in a more immediate sense, the Marines in Helmand province rotate every year or so. And so they start to develop a relationship with a particular squadron. They split, and then there are new guys there. The devil they know, the Taliban, will still be there.
But aren't there also Afghani people who would like to see this end? You profiled the chief of police in Kunduz, which is where he has successfully reduce the growth of opium. I don't know how he's done it, because the way you describe this, the situation is almost impossible. Farmers will lose a lot of income if they switch off of opium.
Sure. Poppies. Well, the guy you're referring to, General Kuntus, the provincial chief of police of Badakhshan, has done a lot in that province to eradicate. But he hasn't done it completely. And there is a sense that police officials there are turning the other way because there are certain favored individuals who are allowed to continue their operations. I did, however, talk to a farmer down in Helmand province, and who was just leaving the Marine compound picking up a bag of seeds for alternative crops. I asked him about all this, and he said, look, you know, you Westerners seem to think the Taliban has put a gun to our head to do this. No, the gun to our head is not the Taliban. The gun to our head is poverty. We don't have any other means of support. I asked him then, well, you know, if that's the case, then are we – you know, being too moralistic, are we judging Afghan farmers unduly because of your reliance on poppy? And he said, no. In fact, it's a real pox on us. He said it's a cancer on our country because he said that the problem is that when there's no other way to make money, it means that the next generation will never become engineers or doctors or veterinarians. They'll only do what I do, which is to grow poppy.
Well, opiates are also used medicinally as painkillers legally. Why isn't there a program to buy the opium poppies from these farmers to make codeine and other things that you find in every hospital?
Well, in fact, a program like that is underway in India, has been for some time, where medicinal opium is permitted and is a thriving part of, you know, of India's economy. The concern, I think, among American officials, and this very thing that you're suggesting, Leonard, has been proposed by some NGOs and strong on-the-ground advocates of this sort of thing. Americans don't trust it. They think that as long as opium is there, that it will fall into the hands of the Taliban, and that, you know, we can say it's for medicinal use, but that's not going to be the case. You're correct, though, that it has always been used for medicine, and unfortunately, in certain areas where there are no medical facilities at all, it has become kind of the catch-all means of of making people feel better. A baby has a cough or something because of the cold season, and a mother will blow opium smoke into the baby's face. The baby will then become addicted to opium, and this is a terrible problem in certain outlying areas of Afghanistan as well as in the big cities.
My guest is Robert Draper, whose article Opium Wars is in the current issue, the February issue of National Geographic magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You went on a poppy eradication mission. Can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Sure. Yeah, that's the chief of police of Badakhshan had invited the photographer David Guttenfelder and myself to go. This was one day after several of his men had been attacked and killed by a roadside bomb, presumably from either Taliban sympathizers or angry farmers, when they were on another eradication raid. So it was with a certain amount of apprehensiveness that we signed on to this. But we went way out into this area called the Argo District of Badakhshan province, a beautiful area that's been heavily reliant on opium for at least 15, 20 years, and watched this eradication team of about 50 or so officers whack away at these poppies with these long bamboo canes.
Is that the best way to do it?
It's the only way to do it in areas such as this that are very hilly. If it's
you
a flat area,
you can't just put them on fire.
Well, you can do that, but then it has a danger of, you know, spreading and destroying over other crops. In flatter areas, they use tractors, but here they use bamboo canes. The farmers had long gone because the team had already eradicated nearby areas, leaving behind the women and children who, while this eradication was taking place, were screaming and wailing and saying to the police, you know, you're ruining our only form of survival. How will we be able to feed our children? The chief of police felt very badly at one point when a woman was saying this to him and handed to the woman's daughter some money that he'd pulled out of his pocket. And the woman hissed to the daughter, give him his money back. And so there's a real hostility there. This is not a policy that farmers are endorsing, even though it's effective.
Well, how are the farmers compensated generally when their fields are destroyed?
In the south, again, in Helmand province, that's a program that the Marines are doing. But elsewhere, when farmers are having their crops eradicated forcibly as opposed to voluntarily, the police are promising some NGO will come, some Western aid will come, and sometimes that happens, sometimes it doesn't. In Badakhshan, for example, almost every farmer we talked to said they promised they would bring us, you know, the seeds for melons or wheat, and it never arrived. And indeed, the police told us the same thing. They said, you know, we're told to make these promises, and we're chagrined to see that they are not being kept.
And I'm assuming that that would make the farmers a little more sympathetic to the Taliban.
Yes, it would. And again, you know, and the Taliban, of course, is not unaware of this dynamic. You know, they are talking to farmers and saying the West is making promises to you that they have no intention of keeping. And in the meantime, they are destroying your only form of survival, in addition to which they aren't even going to be here in another year or two. So it's under that set of circumstances, it's hard to imagine farmers being receptive to what the West is promising.
And you also point out that the poppies are a really good cash crop. But what about some of the other good cash crops? Couldn't they be encouraged to grow saffron, which is rather expensive?
Yes. Yeah. No, in fact, there's a pilot program in Badakhshan and I think further west, maybe in Badghis, of saffron, and it's successful in certain areas. And now there are a couple of problems. One is that saffron requires a little more water, requires irrigation, and many most areas in Afghanistan are not set up for that. The additional problem is that there are market difficulties. The Iranians have a strong say in the saffron market. But no, there are a variety of alternative crops that are being looked at. The development of of these markets is in some cases promising. But I think the most promising that I heard was the idea of developing off-season crops so that they're not competing with their neighbors. For example, building greenhouses in Helmand so that tomatoes can be grown off-season there and then sent out. This would be a way for them not just to develop a market, but to get top dollar for it. And that amount could compete, in fact, with the amount of money they're making from growing poppy.
But is that just a proposal these days?
Or? It's a proposal, actually, yes.
Because we're throwing an awful lot of money into this country. Are we putting money into it for any practical purposes, things that will actually have a long-term effect after we are gone?
Well, the area where the grandest level of experimentation on that score is taking place is in Nangarhar province, where the big city is Jalalabad. And we visited there. That is a country or a province that as recently as 5 or 6 years ago was the number one producer of opium. Now opium has been pretty much eradicated there. And instead you see potato chip factories, honey-making facilities, textile mills, all sorts of things.
Are the farmers happy?
The farmers are happy somewhat. I mean,
they could grow cotton again, couldn't they?
They could, but they're not. The problem, Leonard, is twofold. One is that they're only getting about 60%, about 60 cents on the dollar of what they would be making from opium. So they're hopeful, but things need to get a little bit better. The second thing is that the infrastructure for a lot of this depends on a steady influx of Western aid. I mean, we have really, really flooded the zone, so to speak, in Nangarhar province and spent billions of dollars there. And I remember asking one farmer there that's you know, are you guys about ready to do this on your own? And he said, look, we've been through 30 years of war. It's going to take 80 years or so, you know, of aid to keep us going. And I thought to myself, 80 years? Will the American public stand for that? And that's just Nangarhar province. We haven't even begun in Helmand province or Badakhshan or some of the other producing provinces to pour in that kind of money.
I mentioned that most of this goes, the illegal drugs go to Russia. The U.S. has a serious heroin problem. Is any of this coming here?
Yes, it is. It's hard to trace exactly where the opium ends up. We know, though, that the emergence of Pakistan as an opium producing country, the real emergence, coincides with a demand from both Europe and the United States. So there's certainly a correlation, if not a causal relationship between the two.
But Pakistan and India have largely been able to eradicate that industry. How were they able to do it where Afghanistan can?
It helped to have a stable government and stable governments that
Pakistan has a stable government?
More
relatively.
Relative to Afghanistan, sure, everything is relative. And at least to the extent that it has government institutions upon which people can rely, and absent those, then black, you know, all sorts of black markets, all sorts of black economies begin to flourish.
So right now we have no idea where this stuff is going. Most of it's going to Russia because well, there's a serious drug addiction problem there, and I assume in some of the other countries of the former Soviet Union. Where is most of our heroin coming from?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that there are a variety of places it's coming from, but it stands to reason, Leonard, that given that 90% of the opium in the world comes from Afghanistan, a big chunk of that has got to be going to the United States.
Would the industry in Afghanistan have become so big without the India-Pakistan precedents?
No. I mean, there was an aid worker who had been involved in the eradication efforts in Pakistan who told me we succeeded, but part of what we succeeded in doing was pushing the problem across the border. And so, again, there is a kind of correlation between the stabilization of those governments and the drying up, therefore, of a black market, and a vacuum being filled by a country that now suddenly didn't have anything else to grow because no one else wanted their crops.
I know this isn't your story, but have we learned anything from what happened in South America, where we went after the growth of coca for cocaine and went after the drug lords? There's still plenty of cocaine coming into this country, isn't there?
Sure, there is. And I think that, one thing we can learn from that situation is the near intractability of these problems, but also that that finally external forces can do only so much. I mean, it's the notion that the West can really lead the charge on this is a dubious one. And one of the real tragedies in all this, Leonard, is that we've been there since the latter part of since the end of 2001. From 2002 to 2008, we really had no coherent policy vis-a-vis opium, and for that matter, I think a lot of people would say we coddled the Karzai administration, we gave Hamid Karzai a very, very long rope. And there is not a whole lot to show for that. He has one of the most difficult jobs in the world. Nonetheless, the wisdom of his policies, if indeed there's a coherency to the policies, is very arguable.
And his brother has been implicated in the opium trade.
Circumstantially, the evidence is pretty overwhelming that his brother controls the drug market in Kandahar.
So some people would argue that we should just accept the fact that people are going to take drugs and live in the real world.
Well, I think that there's always going to be a demand for drugs, and that's not the problem for Afghanistan to wrestle with. The problem for Afghanistan to wrestle with is can they develop a legitimate economy? And even if they continue to produce opium the way America produces marijuana, for example, can they move to a system where the dominant cash crop is something other than an illegal drug?
Opium Wars by Robert Draper is in the February issue of National Geographic magazine with photographs by David Guttenfelder. And you can see a slideshow of some of those photographs on our website, along with links to the article. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Leonard.